All right. So, you know, that when you're, when, you know, we upload all our sermons to sermon audio and all that. And what I've found out is if you want people to listen to your sermons, your title is everything. So, you know, you got to have an eye-catching title. So I figured a lot of you guys would appreciate the title this week with Death from Above. And there's more to the story than that, but that's the memorable part of the story. That's probably the only part of the story that maybe those of you that haven't really studied the Judges all that much, which I would think would maybe be a lot of you, that would know. But the rest of the story is probably going to be fairly new, or at least somewhat, I haven't heard that story in a while. I don't think this pops up on many people's preaching registers in most churches, because Judges is some ugly stuff. We've talked about that so far. Now, remember last week, we talked a lot about Gideon's leadership bleeding over into his son Abimelech's leadership, and how Abimelech kind of took Gideon's violence, Gideon's self-servingness, and took it to the next level by wiping out his family, by killing every one of his brothers but one in order to get the throne. And we talked about this idea that the people often get the leader that they deserve. Right. When they compromise and they allow these things to be fudged, and next thing you know, we've got full. And it's the same thing in the church. Right. You know, well, we'll just compromise here and we'll compromise here and we'll compromise here. And next thing you know, you're not even preaching the Bible anymore. And so on one hand, the people do get the leader that they deserve. But on the other hand, the leader often gets the people that he deserves. Okay? And I think there's a little lesson here for us in leadership style. You guys that have leadership positions, you understand this idea. From a Christian perspective, how are we to lead? By example. What else? Did I hear it? Servant, right? Jesus commanded us to be servant leaders, right? And so if you are the dictator, you know, and I'm not saying you can't get things done being the dictator. Right. I mean, we've seen plenty of college football and college basketball coaches over the years that have won a lot of games by being, you know, see Bob Knight, see Woody Hayes, see, you know, whoever you want to see in that example, yelling and screaming, and you were scared of the coach, and that's why you did things the right way. OK, you might get things done that way, but what's the response back with the people back to the coach? Well, eventually those coaches tend to not go out on a high note. Those coaches tend to get run out eventually. And even though it might take a long time, eventually that changes. And that's what's going to happen here. And Abimelech is going to rule selfishly. If you remember, he had to get the support of the men of Shechem in order to ascend to the throne. And what we find out pretty early in this story is that he doesn't even stay in Shechem. He stays down the road. So he claims kingship, but he doesn't even stay with the people that he said, "You're my blood. I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about it." And he seems to be going in a different direction. And there's some hints here about what we see. So it's been said that disillusion is the child of illusion. Do you get what that's saying? Is if you continue to lie to me, I will stop trusting you. You know, if you're fake and fake and fake, don't expect me to think that you're real. All right. And if a king is going to continually say one thing and do another, it will not take long for the people to get very disillusioned with that king. Okay, or president, or whatever you want to put into that block. Okay, so Abimelech made big promises, and he's obviously not delivering. So here's our background. Here's Judges has taught us again and again, God is ultimately in control in Israel. Now, we haven't heard from God in these couple chapters. You know, he has stepped away. Since he clothed Gideon in the Spirit, we have not seen God and in passing reference. But what the author is trying to tell us is God hasn't gone anywhere. You may not hear him in these verses, but he is certainly illustrating what's going on in this story. He may be hidden to the hand of the people. His hand may be hidden to the people involved, but it's obvious for those that have the eyes of faith. And we have a hint of things right here at the beginning, because it starts with when Abimelech had reigned 3 years over Israel. Well, I don't know if you're talking about, I'm going to have a long, healthy reign. Well, 3 years doesn't sound like much of a healthy reign. Okay? And that's our first hint that things are not going well in Israel. Okay, so let's start in verse 22 of Judges chapter 9. Okay, so when Abimelech had reigned 3 years over Israel, then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. that the cruelty done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, that's Gideon, and their blood be laid upon Abimelech their brother, which slew them, and upon the men of Shechem, which aided him in the killing of his brethren. And the men of Shechem set liers in wait for him in the top of the mountains, and they robbed all that came along that way by them, and it was told Abimelech. Now there's some, you know, some King James language in there that makes you have to read those things a couple times, so let's make sure we understand. Number one, God is intervening here, or he has intervened. He's going to avenge the violence committed by Abimelech and by the men of Shechem who helped Abimelech kill his brothers. Right, remember, they broke out 70 pieces of silver from the pagan temple to pay the assassins to go down there and kill all of his brothers. And the translation, evil spirits, probably not the best translation. Not saying God is not sovereign over all spirits, but do you get how it kind of sounds? It sounds kind of strange when it says God sent out an evil spirit. It's more of a spirit that does evil, okay? And maybe that's splitting hairs, but I think there's a little bit of a difference there. And the Net Bible translates it as God sent a spirit to stir up hostility. Right? He's sending a spirit to create animosity between between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, okay? That's just a personal thing for me. So what's God doing here? Well, he's dissolving this allegiance very quickly. He's creating animosity and strife between the two entities that made a covenant in the last chapter. You remember, Abimelech goes to the men of Shechem and says, I am for you guys. You are my blood, and if I'm king, you're going to be taken care of. Well, now there is hostility, and those guys don't like him, and he doesn't like them. Okay, that's the start. So the fracture in the relationship prompts the nobles to back out, to renege on their covenant. They're going to back out and betray Abimelech. And number two, he's punishing Abimelech and the men of Shechem for their role in the murders of the brothers, okay? Which was prophesied in the last chapter by Joram, the brother, right? So, or Jotham, the brother. Now, a little thing with that. I don't know that Jotham was speaking a prophecy. Okay, hear me out on this. Maybe you'll agree or disagree. You don't have to agree with me on this. But I think Jotham, a godly man, recognized injustice, and he spoke out against the injustice, and I think he spoke somewhat prophetically, but you'll notice he didn't get up and said, thus saith the Lord. He spoke, a kind of an imprecatory kind of, this is what's going to happen to you because of what you've done. You betrayed Gideon. Okay? I think it's very similar to what Elijah does when he says it's not going to rain for 3 years. Okay? Elijah doesn't say the same. He doesn't say the Lord says it's not going to rain for 3 years. I think Elijah is so done with Ahab and everything that he's doing. I think he goes in and he says, until you repent, it's not going to rain. And I think God said, I'm going to bless that command. And I think it's the same thing with Jotham. I think Jotham got up there and said, because you did wrong by Gideon, because you were unfaithful, you were traitors, you were treacherous, you are going to suffer and be paid back in kind for what you've done. And I think God said, yep, that's right. That's going to happen. I think that's what's going on there. Okay, so we have an official breakup, okay, on Facebook and everything in verse 25. Because in verse 25, the men of Shechem kind of do an unforgivable act in the eyes of Abimelech. And the Net Bible makes it a little clearer. The leaders of Shechem rebelled against Abimelech by putting bandits in the hills who robbed everyone who traveled by on the road, but Abimelech found out about it. Okay? So one of the big moneymakers for a king, a regional king, was when travelers came through your land, you set up a toll booth of sorts, you set up a collection point, and yeah, you can come right through our land, but it's going to cost you a little bit of money. And that was a big money maker for the king. Well, it seems like what's happening is these guys are paying their tolls, and then they're robbing. These guys are coming in from the hills and robbing people that are traveling through and robbing the tolls that would have gone to Abimelech. And so it's a money maker, and now they've betrayed him and they're taking it. They're probably coming off the mountains in Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Remember the map we saw last week? Shechem's right in the middle of two mountains, so plenty of places for bandits to hide. Okay, now after 25, we would expect, because the end of verse 25 says Abimelech found out about it. Abimelech knew that this was happening. Well, we would think verse 26 would be, and then Abimelech came down and did something about it. But it's not. We take kind of a, you know, flash over to this side of the thing, and the narrative is going to take a little bit of a plot twist. So let's look at verse 26. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brethren and went over to Shechem. And the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. And they went out into the fields and gathered their vineyards and trod the grapes and made merry and went into the house of their God and did eat and drink. And they cursed Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech? And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is not he the son of Jerubbaal and Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for why should we serve him? And would to God this people were under my hand. Then would I remove Abimelech." And he said to Abimelech, "Increase thine army and come out." So what do we have here? We have rebellion. We have an uprising, and we have a guy that's going to be the figurehead of this uprising, this guy named Gaal, who we've never met before out of nowhere. Okay? His name means to loathe, to hate. That's a good name, right? Okay? And we don't know where his origins are, but like Abimelech, the reason he comes to power is because he's related to the guys in Shechem. Okay? And based on these verses, he seems to be kind of a true Shechemite. You know, my dad and grandfather and great-grandfather, we've grown up here. Okay? And he says he descends from Hamor, the founder of the city. That goes all the way back to Genesis. Okay? So he's claiming a long lineage here. And he may have been one of the men of Shechem that originally was at the coronation for Abimelech, and now he's refusing to submit to Abimelech's rule. So, and immediately they make him their champion. Yes, we're following you. It says they put their confidence in him. Okay? So, you know what? We don't like that old king. It's time for a new king. Okay? Talk about the opposite of what God lays out there. God is a God of faithfulness. He's a God of covenant. He's a God of not lying, not changing, you know, immutable kind of stuff. And now we've got these guys that just trade out kings like it's, you know, used cars. You know, I'm tired of that one. I think I'll move to that one. It's almost like dating in 2016 in America. But that's a whole nother conversation we could have. Okay? So what do the Shechemites do? They have a party. Did you notice that? They went out to the vineyards and they got grapes and they made wine and they went to the pagan temple and they had themselves a party. Okay? And I don't know, let's overthrow the king and have a party. It seems like all these pagan groups were always drinking the night before great battles and things, and it never worked out well. They didn't learn their lesson. I mean, look at all the party things we've got going on in verse 27. They went out to the fields, they gathered their vineyards, they trod the grapes. How many times do you say trode in a daily conversation? They trode the grapes. They made merry. They went into the house of their god, Baal-Berith. Remember, that was the same god that the Israelites made a covenant with back when Abimelech became king. And then they ate and they drank. And then number eight, what they did was they cursed Abimelech. And they let drunken Gaal get up and talk to all his drunken buddies. And I mean, you can picture it, right? Like, anybody that's ever been in this situation, like been around or seen this environment, it's the drunk guy that's just talking big, right? Like, if I were a king, it would be so much better around here, you know? And if you will just follow me, I'll get rid of him and everything will be awesome, right? And all his drunk buddies are like, yeah, you know, it's like, that's what's going on. I can just picture these morons in this pagan temple, you know, drunk off their heads, talking about how they're going to get a new king and all that. You know, because nothing prepares you for a great physical exertion the next day like getting, you know, horribly drunk the night before. But that's what they do. Okay? And so he addresses the mob and look at the rhetorical questions. Who's Abimelech? Who is this guy? Right? Well, why does he get to be king? Okay? And that many a revolution has started with that conversation. Okay? Who's Shechem? Like, we are a proud city. Why should we be serving him? He's not even one of us. Okay? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? Okay, and Zebul, his officer, we've got his deputy and him. They're not even Shechemites, and we're letting them rule in our city. What's the deal with that? And he says, we're proud. We go back to Hamor. We go back. That'd be like, you know, us going, you know, we go back to George Washington, and now we're doing that. You know, he quotes the lineage. And he says, why should we serve him? He doesn't deserve our you know, allegiance. Why are we going to serve him? Okay, and then he boasts in verse 29, and would to God this people were under my hand. Again, there's your mention of God. In this flippant sort of, you know, I swear to God, if I were the king, then things would be different. Okay? And then I would remove Abimelech. Again, I think he sounds a lot like a modern politician. You know, if you'll just elect me, I'll fix everything in this country. Okay. And he concludes with this direct challenge. And he said to Abimelech, which he didn't say directly to Abimelech, because Abimelech's not there. Okay? He's talking a lot of trash without Abimelech being in attendance. Like, you've met those people too, right? They're real big talkers when the other guy's not around. Okay? Increase thine army and come out. You know, bring your army out. I'll fight you right here. Okay? Well, that's how that little party ends. And much like Abimelech in verse 2, he plays the kind of the ethnicity card, you know, in this sense. Because remember, Abimelech said, you should follow me as king because my mother is from Shechem and I'll take care of you guys. Okay? And he's saying, my father is from Shechem and that's more important. I'm truly a Shechemite. He's a son of Jerubbaal. He's a son of an Israelite. Okay? You can't trust him. He's not one of us. Okay? I'm one of you guys. My claim's better than his claim. Okay? And Abimelech may be linked through Shechem through his concubine mother, but his identity is determined by his father. And so Gaal can very easily say he doesn't have a right to rule us. Okay? Which from a very kingly definition, especially in a secular sense, he doesn't. Right? We knew that from the very beginning. Okay, so what's really happening? Well, if you remember the words from Jotham back in 19 and 20. If you then have dealt truly and sincerely with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech. Go party, just like they just did, right? And let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. Remember that Jotham said that. Okay? That's very important to the rest of the story. If you dealt honorably with Gideon, then great. Go on with your life. Party on. Okay? If not, let you be devoured by fire. Now, remember, that was said. Okay, verse 30. And when Zabul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was kindled. Now, Zabul is Abimelech's right-hand man. He's running the show in Shechem while Abimelech sits on the throne down the road. And he sent messengers unto Abimelech privily, saying, behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brethren be come to Shechem, and behold, they fortify the city against thee. Now, therefore, up by night, come to us by night, thou and the people that is with thee, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be that in the morning, as soon as the sun is up, thou shalt rise early and set upon the city. And behold, when he and the people that is with him come out against thee, then mayest thou do to them as thou shalt find occasion. Okay? So he says, Abimelech, get that army here tonight. Okay? And you wait in front of the city tonight. And when they walk out in the morning thinking they're ready for a fight, you turn it on and do whatever you feel like doing. Okay? Take them out. Okay, so Abimelech doesn't respond, but Abimelech's deputy does, and he's really upset. He sends messengers out. He advises Abimelech to bring the soldiers. Okay, so Abimelech is going to listen to the advice in verse 34. And Abimelech rose up, and all the people that were with him by night, and they laid wait against Shechem in four companies. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entering of the gate of the city. And Abimelech rose up and the people that were with him from lying in wait. And you can imagine at that point, he knew he was in trouble. Verse 36. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zabul, behold, there come people down from the top of the mountains. And Zabul said unto him, thou seest the shadow of the mountains as if they were men. And Gaal spake again and said, see, there come people down by the middle of the land, and another company come along by the plain of Meonium. Okay? So I don't know what Gaul is doing there. I think it may be like, hey, I've got more troops in the mountain. Look at all the shadows up there. But really, the shadows are from Abimelech's army. That's how many people he's got down there. Abimelech divides his forces into four companies. In the morning, when they saw Gaal and his troops emerge from the city, they're going to start to attack. Zabul must be at the city gate because Gaal engages him and issues a threat. Okay, behold, there come people down from the mountain. You better call your boy off because I got reinforcements coming. And Zabul kind of calls his bluff and says, okay, we'll take that risk, but here's the army for you ready to fight them. Okay? And Zabul says in verse 38, where is now thy mouth? I heard you talking big yesterday at your party. Everybody did. You woke up the whole city with that party, and I was listening to you. And I thought I heard you talking about how awesome you were and how you were going to be king and how if you were leader, you would kick Abimelech out of here. Okay? Wherewith thou saidest, who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Is not this the people that thou hast despised? Okay, here's who you were talking about. You said you could win this army. Remember the last thing you said, increase thine army and come fight me. Okay, they're here. Okay? You were talking big yesterday. Go out and fight them. Okay? So in other words, what Zabul is saying is, if you want to be the man, you got to beat the man. So there's the man down there. You just talked big yesterday. Take your army out there and show them how big you are. Okay, and this is what's going to happen. Okay, Gaul's going to set the challenge. Okay, he's ready for the hurricane, and he's going to go out and he's going to fight Abimelech's army. And I'll just go ahead and a little spoiler there. It is not going to go well for Gaal. Verse 39. And Gaal went out before the men of Shechem and fought with Abimelech, and Abimelech chased him, and he fled before him, and many were overthrown and wounded, even unto the entering of the gate. And Abimelech dwelt at Arumah, and Zabel thrust out Gaal and his brethren, that they should not dwell in Shechem. Well, in three verses, the army gets whooped, right? And they don't all die. Some of them do, but many of them are wounded, and they are ejected from the city, kicked out, exiled, okay, humiliated probably in the whole series. Okay, they're routed by the king, many fall into the city gates, Abimelech leaves the city, and they clean up to his deputy Zabel, and he goes back to his palace back in Arumah, which is down the road. But he's not done. Now, if you remember his dad, remember when Gideon ran into those cities in the Transjordan, Penuel, and wanted help. And remember they said, you know, you don't have the king yet, we're not going to serve you. And remember when he came back to those cities and he whipped them with briars and thorns, and then the other city he pulled down their tower and killed all the men in the city, right? It was like, okay, when somebody turns on me, then I'm going to get it back, and I'm going to get it back times 10. It's, you know, it's not an eye for an eye, it's an eye and an arm and a leg for an eye. I mean, that seems to be Gideon's process, and that's going to be Abimelech's process too. So look what happens in verse 42. And it came to pass on the morrow, so the next day, that the people went out into the field. These are not the ones that were fighting against him. These are the people of Shechem. Okay, they went out into the field. lose my place when I look up like that. Verse 42, right? And they told Abimelech, and he took the people and divided them into three companies and laid wait in the field. And looked, and behold, the people were come forth out of the city, and he rose up against them and smote them. All right, so these are just the people of the city. They're coming out to do their work for the day. They're coming into the fields, and when they walk out of the city gate in the morning, they run into Abimelech's army, who's waiting for them. He left the previous day. Everybody thought it was done. He shows back up the next day, and he goes after the people of the city working in the fields. These are not the soldiers that fought against him. These are civilians, as it were. Okay, in verse 44, and Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood in the entering of the gate of the city, and the two other companies ran upon all the people that were in the fields and slew them. And Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he took the city and slew the people that was therein and beat down the city and sowed it with salt. Okay, so Gaul and his forces are gone. They got exiled in the previous day. These are not the ones that rebelled against him. So what is Abimelech doing? Well, he's sending a message that I'm the king around here. And what's he doing? It's the same thing that almost all empires do, right? Is what do you do to people that are treasonous? Well, you make sure that the punishment is so awful that anybody that would think about rebelling against you says, I saw what happened to those guys when it happened. It's crucifixion. That's the whole reason behind crucifixion and how public crucifixion is because that's the guy that rebelled against Rome. And if you don't want to be nailed to a cross, you better get in line and pay your taxes. Right? Same idea. So Abimelech divides his forces into three companies, sets ambushes, and kills Shechemites. And as people exit the city, Abimelech's forces attack. They strike them down in the fields. They cut off the city gate. And if that weren't enough, he moves against the city itself, capturing the city, slaughtering the residents. Then he raised the city to the ground and spread salt over it. Well, why the salt? Yeah. Now it is truly a dead city. So if anybody wants to rebuild the city right now, the ground doesn't grow crops. It's uninhabitable at this point. Okay? So, I mean, you talk about total war, total destruction. It's exactly what Abimelech does. Now, Jeroboam's going to rebuild Shechem in 1 Kings chapter 12, which is quite interesting because Jeroboam's another, you know, pagan king that, you know, does all this crazy stuff, and he's the one that decides to rebuild Shechem. But that's on down the road a little bit. So for a while, Shechem is a pile of dirt with salt all over it. That's all it is. It's been burned to the ground, every bit of it. Okay? Now, they know where, and I'll show you a picture in a little bit, they found Shechem, and there's evidence of all this. So. Okay, and believe it or not, it's going to get worse. Like if that was, you know, tearing down the entire city and covering all the fields with salt, that seems like that would send the message pretty well. Well, there's a few survivors after that. Okay, verse 46. And when all the men of the tower of Shechem heard that, so that this tower of Shechem, there must have been men that worked specifically there. And the tower was probably connected to the temple, the pagan temple that they have. Okay, so these men that almost like, you know, pagan priests, you know, things like that. That's who I think these men are. They entered into a hold of the house of the god Bareth. They run into the temple, their pagan temple. Now, what was going on in that same place the night before?
A party.
And tonight, it's a little different. So they go running in there for protection. Okay? And their god Bareth. And it was told Abimelech that all the men of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together. And Abimelech got him up to Mount Zalmon, which I think is where the tower was. He and all the people that were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bow from the trees and took it and laid it on his shoulder and said unto the people that were with him, "What you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done." And all the people likewise cut down every man his bow or bow and followed Abimelech and put them to the hold, the tower, and set the hold on fire upon them so that all the men of the Tower of Shechem died also, about 1,000 men and women. Hey, so I told you, it got worse. As if killing almost everybody in the city and tearing into the ground wasn't enough, there were about 1,000 men, women, and children left. They retreat into their tower, their strong tower, the tower of their god that they trusted in, right? And Abimelech sets fire to the tower and burns all of them alive in the tower. Okay? So you want to talk about taking it to the next level. That's about as far as it goes, right? Now, two things with that. It shows you the brutality of Abimelech. And two, it's going to set up the last part of our story. Okay, so remember the plan here and how well this worked out for him in a minute. Now, there's a picture of the tell at Shechem. Okay. Now, the way this is designed, you know, a little bit of archaeology and history for you, is when you would see these ancient cities, and most of these ancient cities are like this, the raised part is in the center. Okay, and there was a tower right here, which is probably the one that Abimelech burns down. Okay? And this is the upper city. In most of these cities, there was an upper city and a lower city. Okay? In the upper city, you may have had like the towers, the temples, things like that. And the lower city is where people lived and worked. Okay? So all this stuff down here along the walls, that would have been the lower city. That's these compartments, people would have lived down here. Okay, around the city gates and everything. This is where the marketplace would have been, right in the city gate as you walk in. So that's the lower city. And it seems like at the beginning of the day, after it kills everybody out here, okay, they didn't have the parking lot back then, but this is the lower part of the city that he destroys initially and destroys all the fields. Okay? And the people that are left retreat up the hill and hide in this tower, and that's where he goes up. They've got nowhere to go, and he burns the place down with everybody still inside of it. Okay. Again, you want to talk about a dictator, a leader, a tyrant, that may be what we have there in Abimelech. Okay. And Abimelech engages in total war. The men of the Tower of Shechem, presumably their families, because it says women and children were there. They go back there for protection. We don't know where the location of Mount Zalmon is, but I think it's that hill in the middle of the city. And Abimelech burns the place down. Again, the place where they partied the night before is now the tomb. Okay, so maybe there's a connection there. Maybe there's and the God that was supposed to protect them can do nothing for them in the face of Abimelech. Not because God's driving it, but because Abimelech is just that wicked. Okay, and the first part of the curse from Jotham was, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo. And the house of Millo is probably the men that worked in that tower. So the prophecy literally, quite literally comes true because flames came out from Abimelech and devoured these men, okay, that hid in that tower. The same men that probably named him king, the same men that supported him in his initial run, now die at his hand in this tower. Okay? Okay, all right, go too far. Yeah, we're there. So we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, this is the man that killed 68 of his brothers on one stone. Ceremonially murdered all of them. And these men that he burned in the tower are probably the ones that supported him initially to be king. Okay? He is the very meaning of a despot and a tyrant. Okay? Verse 50. Then went Abimelech to Thebes or Thebes and encamped against Thebes and took it. So it seems like after that, he's like, I need more ground. He's expanding his kingdom. So he goes to another city. But there was a strong tower within the city. Well, that shouldn't be a thing to Abimelech. He just took care of one of those. And thither fled all the men and women. So they do the exact same thing the previous city. They all go hide in the tower. And all they of the city, and shut it to them, and got them up to the top of the tower. And Abimelech came unto the tower and fought against it and went hard unto the door of the tower to burn it with fire. So what's he doing? Well, just work down the road. We'll do the exact same thing. They hide in the tower. He's going to burn the tower. And the door to the tower is probably wooden. That's where you start the fire. Right? And it'll spread all the way through the tower. And if you're at the top of the tower, there's no way out. Okay? So he's going to do the exact same thing. So the question after that is, well, okay, the fire consumed the men and women of Shechem. Well, did Abimelech get off scot-free? Does he get a pass on this? And what these verses are going to tell us is no. Abimelech is not going to get a pass. After his destruction of Shechem, Abimelech sets out to enhance his power in Israel and extend the borders of his realm. He sets his sights on Thebes, where he sets up his military camp and begins an assault on the city gates. Hey, the citizens hide just like the citizens of Shechem did. They lock the door. They climb to the top of the tower. And seeking to replicate his victory at Shechem, Abimelech attacks the tower, tries to burn it down, beginning at the doorway, which would have been made of wood. What he doesn't know or notice is that there is something going on above him. Okay? And there's this woman who is unnamed. We don't know who she is. But she picks herself up a millstone. Okay? And this is where our title is going to come from. Okay, verse 53. And a certain woman cast a piece of a millstone upon Abimelech's head and all to break his skull. So Abimelech goes all the way to the door with the flames to light the door on fire. And then from directly above him in the tower, here comes the millstone. Okay, now we don't know how tall the tower is, but you don't call like a two-story building a tower. So this is being dropped from a pretty good height. Now, what's the size of the millstone? Well, depending on what you look at, it seems like millstones were about 18 inches in diameter. Okay, so a foot and a half across and heavy. Okay, most of the time, a woman wouldn't be able to pick one up by herself. So it's almost like God just gives her the strength to pick this up. And I think the sovereign God is working here, as we see later. Okay, verse 54. Then he called hastily unto the young man, his armor bearer, and said unto him, draw thy sword and slay me, that men say not of me, a woman slew him. And his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man unto his place. Okay, so there's our death from above, right? Dropping the millstone on his head. Now, it's probably hard to kind of illustrate, but I'd imagine a millstone dropped from that height. He was in pretty bad shape once he got hit by that. Even if it wasn't a direct hit, he was in, I mean, that's a neck breaking kind of thing, right? And just when we think the tower's going to get burned down, just like we think it's going to keep going and Abimelech's reign of terror continues, this nameless woman, again, perhaps with extraordinary strength, picks up a millstone, threw it from the roof of the tower down on Abimelech's head. And the king regains consciousness long enough to command his armor bearer to stab him with his sword to spare him a humiliating death at the hands of a woman. Now, that should sound not necessarily the woman part, but the asking the armor bearer to kill him part. A future king of Israel will do that same thing. Saul will be in that exact same position. Okay? When I see these things, and it's fairly common in that time period, that was a, you know, rather than suffer and die, they would take kind of that easy way out. Again, Shakespeare reference for the week is Julius Caesar. And at the end of Julius Caesar, we have two characters that are in that situation. Okay, and just to paint in this, I just think it paints the picture a little bit. You've got Brutus and you've got Cassius, right? And these two guys were allies in the assassination of Caesar. Brutus is honorable. Everything about him is honor. Okay, I love the name of honor more than I fear death is what he says. And Cassius is the exact opposite. And by the way, if you think in Acts 17 that Pastor Sean's been preaching on Sundays, Brutus is a Stoic, Cassius is an Epicurean. Okay, and they're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. And both of them are about to get captured, and they know if they get captured, they're going to be humiliated, paraded through the streets, and everything else. And they both say, for totally different reasons. Brutus because I can't be dishonored, and then Cassius because he's really going to treat me bad because he hates me. So they asked their armor bearer, will you kill me? Hold the sword and let me fall on the sword. Okay? And with Cassius, he goes to his armor bearer and he says, "Will you hold the sword for me?" And the armor bearer is like, "Yeah, here you go." Dead. Like that. And then Brutus goes and it takes Brutus like five people. He goes to the first guy and he says, "Will you hold the sword for me?" And he says, "No, I will not hold the sword that killed Brutus. You're too much of an honorable man." He goes to the next guy, "No, I can't do that. I love you too much. You're too honorable. I can't do it." And I think about that, and I think if I was walking around the church and with a gun and said, "Hey, will you shoot me?" Like most of you would say, "No, I don't want to shoot you." But if you were like, "Oh, sure," that would not, that'd be the moment before death where I'd be like, they don't like me very much. I would hope you guys would try to talk me out of it. That's all I'm saying. But with Cassius, it happens just like that. And I think it's the same thing here. The armor bearer doesn't hesitate. Like, all right, boom, done. All right. And as soon as he's dead, look at what the rest of Israel does. All right, boys, I think it's time to go home. You know, nothing else to do here. Let's go back to let's go back to the house. We're done with this whole thing. And to say that, I mean, here's the irony too, right? Kill me so people won't say I got killed by a woman. And here we are reading the story thousands of years later of him being killed by this woman. Okay? He didn't escape the humiliation that he thought he was going to escape. So not only killed by a pagan, but killed by a pagan woman. And Abimelech remains belligerent, defiant, arrogant to the end, you know, like, just kill me and nobody will remember this. No, they're going to remember that. And the irony is that what was accomplished so much so quickly. I mean, he got the kingship overnight, you know. He kills all his brothers. He murders his rivals. He staved off a revolt, you know, overnight as well. He ruined a whole other city. He falls victim to a woman with a millstone. Okay? And the message the author is trying to tell you there is, God is in total control. This guy thinks he's big stuff. This guy thinks he's untouchable. And what takes him down? A woman with a millstone in the tower. Not some great army. Not some great warrior. A woman in the tower that drops a millstone on his head. Right? And I think it's a repeat kind of JL from chapter 4. Right? Like, I want the glory. No, you're not going to get the glory. This woman's going to get the glory. This woman that nobody knows, she's getting the glory because God's in control of the situation. So a little more irony, and I think there's a lot in this whole story. Abimelech's kind of the macho man of the story. He gained the kinship because of a woman, his mother. His mother was a Shechemite, and that allowed him to be king. And he loses his kingship because of this woman with the millstone. So there's women on both ends of the story. So all these people that like to talk about the Bible being anti-woman, well, women are all over this story and they're playing major, major roles. So that's a bad interpretation. One woman gave him life, the other took his life. Okay, book ends that pretty nicely. Okay, and the man who killed all of his brothers upon one stone had one stone dropped on his skull and killed him. Okay, interesting how that all worked out. So seeing Abimelech dead, his men abandon the siege and they head home. Hey, notice that these men are called the men of Israel, which means he must have had a pretty good following. He had a lot of people following, especially after Shechem. And so he had at least the northern part of the kingdom, I think, he had under his control. And with his death, the Israelite experiment of kingship based on the Canaanite model, their own kind of design, it ends right here. Okay? And here's what I mentioned earlier, the kingly parallels, right? Abimelech's request to be finished off by his armor bearer is similar to Saul's later request so as to avoid dishonor. That's 1 Samuel 31. Thus, the careers of Israel's first self-made king, Abimelech, and first divinely designated king, Saul, end in disgrace. Abimelech is an idolater from the beginning, and Saul is rejected by God for disobeying God's explicit command. So these kings that try to do their own thing rather than following God's commands doesn't end well for them. Okay? 56 and 57, and we'll be done with that chapter. And here we go. Thus, God rendered the wickedness of Abimelech, which he did unto his father, in slaying his 70 brethren. And all the evil of the men of Shechem did God render upon their heads. And upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. So here's all this wickedness, all this stuff going on. And what the author reminds you at the end of chapter 9 is, God brought this to pass. God brought this to Abimelech. God brought this to the men of Shechem. God orchestrated this entire thing. Okay? Jotham's curse is fulfilled. Let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and the house of Millo. That happened. And let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from the house of Millo and devour Abimelech. Well, it may not have literally happened the same way, but that's exactly what happened. He was devoured by his own insatiable urge for power and killed by that millstone. That's right. That's a good one. He was fired. Okay? In Donald Trump style, right? So, what's in a name? Abimelech's name meant my father, the king. And in his attempts to live up to his name, Abimelech's demise instead points to the original intent of the name, which was my heavenly father is king. So what the author of Judges is telling you at the end of chapter 9 is he thought his father being king made him who he was. Well, the fact that God is king made him who he was at the end of this chapter, which was beaten down and defeated. Okay? Neither man's pretension or violence could dislodge the Lord from his throne. That's what you see over and over again in this book, is in all the chaos, in all the ugliness, in all the violence, God is sovereign. Even when he's not speaking, even when he's not intervening, he is still orchestrating the events of his people Israel. Okay? And I thought this, and I'll end with this quote here. I thought this was interesting. Commentator said, in this book of Judges, we observe the mercy of God at work in as sharp relief as anywhere else in Scripture. The greatest threats to Israel's existence do not come from outside enemies who may occasionally oppress them. Israel's most serious enemy is within. She is a nation that appears determined to destroy herself. Only the gracious intervention of God prevents this from happening. And again, I just think United States of America. Okay? It's not the outer things, the external things we got to worry about. It's the internal thing. All our founding fathers said that too. Right? The democracy will fall. The republic will fall from the inside, not from the outside. Right? And if we want to take that to an individual level, it's the same thing. Right? We don't necessarily, you know, people love to say, and I'm not diminishing Satan by any means, but there are a lot of people that think the devil is behind every tree. Okay? And I'm not saying he's not out there doing his work. Okay? But we can get in plenty of trouble all by ourselves. We don't need his help, right? Our sin natures get us there. You can't control what Satan does, but through the Holy Spirit, you can have control over your own body, over your own mind, over your own thoughts, right? So what is it we have to worry about? We have to worry about the trouble within. Israel had to worry about the sin within the nation. The United States has to worry about the sin in the nation. We have to worry about the sin within ourselves. Okay? Surely we know the external battle. But guess what? You've got the armor of God. If you're standing in that, the external battle isn't the problem. You've got to deal with your own heart. And it's the same thing. And you see what happens in these situations. When you get power, when you get fame, when you get prestige, you turn into an Abimelech. And we may not be kings and we may not be tearing down cities, but we get awful prideful and we start running our own show, right? And I think there's a lesson here to be learned for that. So that's all for Judges for 2016. So we will be back, January the whatever that is, the first week of January, we will be back. So I expect you guys to remember everything we've talked about for the last 4 months or so and pick up right where we left off in a few weeks. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for today. Thank you for this time. Even in this crazy story, this ugliness of human nature in your word, you teach us lessons. You show us your sovereign hand and help us to continue to trust in that, to have faith in you and what you're doing and what you will do. We trust you, Lord. We love you. And keep us safe as we go from here tonight, Lord. Help us to remember to pray for one another. Help us to remain focused on you this Christmas season. Lord, bless us with safe travels, those that are leaving town, and with those that have relatives coming in. And may you get all the honor and glory this Christmas season. In Jesus' name, amen.